This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Step inside and get briefed. This week on whether the UK is at risk of following the US and having an opioid crisis of its own. But before we start, if you enjoy this podcast, please, please tell a friend or write a review. Thanks to Xtrapnel, Jaden J and YDHCFOGI13 for your recent five-star ratings. And now, on with this week's show.
People say, you know, this has only been recognized because it's a middle-class white problem. And that's absolutely true. But I would also say this. This was hidden for many years because it was a middle-class white problem. Because that class of people in our country was mortified beyond words.
That's American journalist Sam Quinones talking about the opioid addiction crisis in the U.S., where one person dies every 12 minutes due to opioid overdose. The problem is hidden no more. But are we in danger of seeing something like it happen in this country? This week, the Secretary of State for Health, Matt Hancock, said we must act now to protect people from the darker side to painkillers. And although the situation here is barely comparable to the US, Department of Health figures show prescriptions for opioid painkillers in England and Wales have risen sharply over the past decade, from 14 million in 2008 to 23 million last year. In this week's programme, I want to find out how the opioid problem in America got so out of control and whether we could be on the cusp of a similar crisis in the UK. Step inside the briefing room to find out. Let's start in the United States. Last year, Donald Trump declared the opioid crisis a national health emergency. But how did that crisis come about? Sam Quinones, the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, takes up the story.
I think the origins have to do with the fact that for many, many years, we didn't use opiate painkillers almost at all. But there was this great fear in this country, particularly among doctors, that use of these drugs would create addicts among their patients, that things would get out of control, and that they might be prosecuted or that they might be held responsible.
But the constant search for better pain management pushed pain specialists to want to reassess the use of opioids. Some believed that they weren't likely to be addictive when used in pain treatment. They just needed evidence.
So they began to look for documentation for their claim, and they found almost none except for an obscure letter to the editor written to the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980 from a doctor in Boston who ran a patient database of hospital records. And he found that of the people who were given narcotic painkillers while in hospital, almost 12,000 patients, only four got addicted. So he writes this up in a letter, 101 words. They publish it in the back of the New England Journal of Medicine edition in January of 1980 under the heading Addiction Rare in Patients Treated with Narcotics. A very unfortunate headline. It should have been far more nuanced. This letter is discovered by pain specialists and quoted and cited, and then it's picked up by pharmaceutical companies and quoted and cited. It's quoted at continuing medical education seminars, and it's quickly picked up as almost gospel that this is proof now that we can use these pills indiscriminately almost, because science now knows that they won't addict people if these are people in pain. That's not at all what the letter said. The letter said if you treat people in hospital under very strict scrutiny, that you will run very little risk of addiction, which is true. The letter writer, Dr. Jick, was completely misinterpreted. Almost nobody had ever read the letter.
But they knew about it.
I would say that this letter became part of how doctors change their minds across America from coast to coast in how they were supposed to use these pills. But it's not just the fact that they're beginning to use these pills in more situations. It's that they're also using these pills in enormous quantities. So people would go home from routine surgery, appendix operations, and you know that the pain is only going to last 2 or 3 days with 30 days worth of these pills. Because, you know, if the pills are virtually non-addictive, it doesn't matter how many of them you give to a patient. And so we began to see this massive explosion in the supply of narcotic pain pills prescribed to patients by doctors for all manner of things, and dentists too.
So how addictive did they turn out to be?
The quantities that you are actually prescribed matter. Studies have shown that if you go 90 days with 100 milligrams a day of these things, you're virtually insured of being dependent and possibly addicted if you don't have these things anymore. People would take them because the doctor had prescribed them and I'm supposed to finish the bottle, you know, right? And so people would get addicted that way. The other problem, of course, is that when you have all these pills exploding out into the medicine cabinets in every part of the country, literally from coast to coast, you have an enormous risk of abuse by high school students, people, workers at a house frequently stealing the pills. People can't make their bills at the end of the month. They sell some of their pain pills, creating for the first time, really, an enormous black market on the street of communities all across the country.
There was one drug in particular that seemed to be catching on. Its brand name was OxyContin. It came to the market in 1996 and was heavily promoted.
OxyContin's crucial in all this. It created addictions and dependency levels in people that are very high. And sometimes this was at the urging of the doctors, prescribing by doctors. Okay, that's not working. We're going to push you up further. Well, frequently what happened, doctor goes, oh my God, what have I done? I created an addict. I'm cutting you off. At that point, the person has no access to the drugs, has to get them on the black market where they're charging increasingly 50 cents a milligram to a dollar a milligram.
But what about the demographics of opioid addiction? Were the same kind of people being affected as in previous drug crises?
Almost entirely, and greatly at odds with every other drug scourge we've ever had in this country, this problem affected white people and virtually only white people. At first, it was low-income whites in economically devastated areas like Appalachia or the Rust Belt, in areas of industrial decline. As a country, frankly, much to our shame, we ignored those areas when they began to have this problem. But very soon, it began to spread, and it began to spread to some of our best-off suburbs. Charlotte, North Carolina, the suburbs of Charlotte, which is a banking center, they have had a bad problem. Salt Lake City and its suburbs, Indianapolis. So you began to see people who had done very, very well also getting addicted and dying to drugs used to numb pain. And you would look at their lives and you go, like, what pain? You have everything, right? You have everything you need. That population was very, very ashamed and kept it quiet. And so that it spread to those areas because people in those areas were so mortified that their kid had died in this way, or their husband had died, or their wife. Nobody wanted to make it public. Everyone hid the truth in shame and in darkness. And that is why also it spread pretty much across the country, because there was this almost conspiracy of silence born out of shame by the very families that it was affecting the most. But I have to say also that a big part of this was our desire, I think, as a culture now, to kind of have our pain fixed without having to do too much work to do it. And it was Americans' search for that, I think, that is one of the major roots of this problem all across the country today.
Sam Quinones, there's an obvious question that leaps out at you here. In the lead up to this crisis, what were the regulators doing? The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is the US agency responsible for regulating medicines. Until 4 weeks ago, anesthesiologist Professor Rayford E. Brown chaired the FDA's Advisory Committee on Anesthetic and Analgesic Drug Products. I spoke to him down the line from Kentucky. Professor Brown, in your view, was it the FDA's job to stop this opioid epidemic from happening in the first place?
David, I think that was absolutely the job of the FDA. The function of the Food and Drug Administration in the United States is largely to protect the public health. And that is, in fact, in their mission statement. It's their reason to be. I think they were asleep at the switch.
Now, can I ask you about the role of the pharmaceutical companies? Because one of the things that's often said is that they played a significant part, I suppose, in persuading the FDA that their products were safer than actually they were.
I think that is likely true, but the pharmaceutical industry is an industry, and we must remember that the pharmaceutical industry has a goal, and the goal would be to create profit for those people that have invested in their company. So my experience with the pharmaceutical industry as the chair of the Advisory Committee on Analgesics for the FDA for the last 4 or 5 years has been that they will really give any information that they think will be helpful in getting the point across that their drug is one that should be approved and it should be prescribed and it should be used by patients, whether or not that is true or not. Some people have jumped from the FDA into the pharmaceutical industry. That's a big deal here in the United States, being able to go from being in a regulatory job to being in a pharmaceutical job. And there's jump shifts that go along all the time where people start in the FDA, transfer to pharmaceutical industry at an elevated salary, and sometimes then go back to the FDA at an elevated place. And in fact, with OxyContin, the person that actually did the initial evaluation on OxyContin became an employee of Purdue Pharmaceuticals about 18 months after that drug was signed off on. And that was not the only person that went directly from the FDA to the pharmaceutical industry.
Professor Rayford Brown. The FDA says it's taking steps to deal with the opioid crisis, including helping to reduce exposure to opioids and promoting tighter prescribing practices. Anyway, that's the experience in the States. But in a week that started with a warning from the Health Secretary, just how much is the UK at risk of its own opioid crisis? Joining me is Dr. Luke Mordecai, a consultant anaesthetist at University College Hospital in London. Dr. Luke Mordecai, you've conducted a study looking at opioid prescription levels in England. What did that show?
So we know that there are some areas with a huge amount more than others. The highs were mostly up north and the lows were down in the south, and that's the strong socioeconomic relationship I found there. 9 of the 10 highest prescribing areas were all in the north of England, bar Bristol, which is a sort of an outlier, which we don't quite know why that's such a hotspot. And then all of the lowest prescribing areas were in what could be described as more affluent areas down in the south, particularly around London. This study really raises more questions than it answers. So I said it proves there is variation. What it doesn't do past conjecture is actually state why that is. And that is the next step, because obviously then we can start doing something about it. And I think there's a good study that's come out recently in Lancet Psychiatry, which has looked at a similar thing, but over a longer period. And they've taken this a step further and they've started to say that rural practices, large GP practices, and also ones with lower socioeconomic inhabitants around are the highest prescribing. So we're starting to at least ask the right questions and begin to answer them as well.
So what would you say that those conclusions, even if they're interim, were suggestive of?
With complex or long-term pain, there's 20 years worth of history behind the problem as to why we're prescribing more opioids, a lack of provision of care in specialist services, mixed messages being propagated or promulgated via the press and policymakers. I think patients are scared of specialist clinics taking medications away. I think there's, amongst the specialist community, there's an absolute belief now that for long-term non-malignant pain, opioids are not considered to be a useful treatment anymore. And the trouble with that is I come on a program like this and say this as a clinician, so we know what's true on a population basis, but I wouldn't want to scare any patients away from engaging because they're not going to turn up to a clinic and have their opioids yanked away from them because everyone's different. And part of the problem is when you do find yourself on very high levels of opioids, you often have a complex medical history, and that requires time, effort, and far more than the available resources of a 7-minute general practice appointment, despite and a lot of respect to my colleagues in primary care, who I think do a fabulous job. I think it's too much to ask to embark upon opiate weaning or the multidisciplinary team approach that's required in this patient population.
Would you describe the way in which we're talking about a possible opioid crisis here as having been helpful?
We need to take a sort of long, hard pause about using terms like epidemic and crisis, because I think we need calm, proactive policy. And I think comparisons with the US, where in that particular healthcare system there are completely different drivers and pushes and pulls, I don't think we're headed in that direction here. That's my personal view.
What would be the big difference?
The incentive structure is such in this country that I don't think clinicians are driven in the same way to prescribe opiates. Notwithstanding, the paper that I mentioned earlier has shown that I think since 97, the total amount that's prescribed has more than doubled. There is clearly something that needs to be done sensibly and in a timely fashion, but in one that withstands the test of time and isn't a reactive policy that then drives patients away from specialist care or creates a lot more red tape.
Now, I imagine that from what you've been saying, that the first thing that we should start with is collecting better information.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, unless even in my study, we know what's being dispensed at a pharmacy. We don't know where it's going. We don't know whether a patient's taking it. We don't know whether it's, you know, 5 bottles of morphine are sat behind the kitchen sink for the next 10 years. We don't know whether it's been diverted to the black market, which we know that happens with some. Just because it's being prescribed, it doesn't mean it's being taken. So what I'd be interested in is seeing exactly who the large opioid users are. And we know that those on high doses of opioid have higher morbidity and mortality, consume a lot more healthcare resources, and generally don't have great quality of life. So they're a population we need to identify and I'd like to think try and help.
Dr. Luke Mordecai there on the position now. So if we don't want to see the misuse of opioids increase, what changes do we need to make, both in terms of policy and public awareness? Joining me in the studio is Professor Leslie Colvin from the University of Dundee, where she's chair in pain medicine, and Dr. Emily Finch, a consultant addiction psychiatrist at the South London and Maudsley NHS Trust. Leslie Colvin, you were involved in writing new clinical guidelines for Scottish health professionals right back in 2013. Why was this then thought necessary? What were people worried about?
The need for the guidelines was recognised partly because there was such a big increase in the number of people suffering from chronic pain. Until those guidelines were produced, there were no comprehensive evidence-based guidelines about how to assess and manage chronic pain.
What did you learn about opioid use in Scotland?
What we did show was that there was a significant increase in opioid prescribing over the 10-year period that we looked at, which was 2003 to 2013, from around about 3 million prescriptions in 2003 to over 6 million in 2013.
So a doubling.
A doubling. And what we also looked at, and we focused down on 1 year in a bit more detail in 2012, and at that point in time, 18% of the Scottish population were prescribed some form of opioid, which is a phenomenal number of individuals.
Emily, in your experience, is there a correlation with the rise in people being prescribed opioids and a rise in people becoming addicted?
I think that's very difficult to say. I think it's important that we don't confuse, in England, at least as far as I've seen, broadly two populations. We have a group using illicit heroin, largely, and there is a small overlap between the use of heroin and the use of opiates that could be prescribed, although sometimes those are obtained illegally. There's also a group who become addicted to opioids following being prescribed them by pain. And there is an overlap between the two groups. The problem is the group who become addicted following being prescribed for pain don't generally come to treatment services. So although we know there's a rise, like Scotland and England, in the amount of prescriptions provided, what we haven't really seen is an increase in the number of opiate users presenting to treatment.
Why would that be?
I think the services that are provided for drug and alcohol users are not really the sort of services, generally speaking, that people would want to come to if what they're doing is overusing pain medication.
Leslie, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, so in 2003, I was involved in setting up a specialist pain and addiction service in Edinburgh, where I worked at the time. At that point, we managed predominantly patients who had misuse of heroin and other illicit substances. Over the subsequent 15 years, there was a really dramatic change in the referral pattern to that service, such that when I left last year, at least half of the individuals that we were seeing were running into problems with prescription opioids. Now, not all of them necessarily met the strict definition of addiction, but they certainly had problematic opioid use from prescription drugs.
Can I ask you both, what are the characteristics of the sort of people who would present in this way, as opposed to, say, people who were what we might think of as more conventional addicts?
I think they're often people who the problem comes very gradually. They start to get into problems with their supply because maybe the prescriber becomes more and more uncomfortable about prescribing it. And they just begin to notice that if they're not taking the drugs, they don't feel right. And that process takes many people quite a long time to realise it. And I don't think we work with service users and patients enough to help them understand those changes that can happen gradually.
Leslie, what kind of people are they? I mean, are they older, younger?
From the work that we did looking at the prescribing within Scotland, if you were female and older, you were more likely to be prescribed a strong opioid. But that's a very general overview and doesn't necessarily indicate problematic use. I think Emily raised a good point about the stigma of attending a drug and alcohol misuse service, in that those individuals who have, if you like, if they've been prescribed the medication by their own doctor, they don't recognise themselves as being addicted. And it's very difficult for them to accept attending a substance misuse service.
So you're essentially saying that almost certainly is a considerable problem of hidden addicts. And we also heard this earlier from the United States, which is that people would be reluctant to admit to themselves, to their families, that this was actually something that had happened to them. Emily?
What we haven't really seen yet is a large number of these people, in large volumes, there may be some people moving into the illicit market, which is what we're seeing in the US. And there are probably a variety of reasons for this. It may be that our prescribing is better controlled than in the US. Doctors are more constrained by the rigours of the NHS, which put limits on people's prescribing.
Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think some of that is true. But I do think there is a risk that what we do is create people who go to the illicit market. In fact, we're seeing fewer people presenting as illicit heroin users. They're dropping. And like Scotland, in England, we are seeing older people and women who are more likely to be addicted to painkillers. So the same patterns is being seen.
I think the other thing that was interesting when I worked within the pain and addiction services is that it's very clear that if you want a prescription opioid, if you are moving in the right circles, you will know where to source that on the illicit market. So the more that we prescribe that is not actually used by the patient, there's an increasing pool of prescription opioids available in society for misuse.
They're just out there, that have just somehow leaked into the system.
Yeah, so we need to be aware of that as prescribers.
The other thing we are not entirely aware yet of is the effect of internet suppliers. That may become quite a factor.
To turn the question back to the people doing the prescribing, is it your view, Leslie, that there are some physicians who are over-prescribing?
I think that's a difficult question and you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. If you're presented with a patient who's hugely distressed and in significant amounts of pain and who's become intolerant to their opioid and is requesting more opioid, it's maybe very difficult to say, actually, I'm going to stop that prescribing or reduce it, particularly if the services that you need to access, so physiotherapy, psychological therapies, that there may be waiting lists for 6 months or even longer to access those services. So we need to look at how we structure our services very particularly for that group of patients.
Well, you're a specialist in pain relief, so I suppose a question related to that is, are these drugs really necessary for pain relief?
That's an interesting question. So in a recent study that was published last year, looked at how patients did if you were prescribed either a strong opioid or a non-opioid type painkiller and followed them up for a year. And what they found was a year later, the patients who were in the strong opioid actually had worse pain scores and weren't able to do any more. So that's a good question. Should we be using them at all?
Emily, do you think in that case, doctors should be more willing to say no, probably from the outset? Let's not do it this way. Let's find another management system.
I mean, I agree with Leslie. It is a very difficult clinical situation when you have someone who is in a lot of pain. But I think the lessons we're learning would seem to indicate that doctors should become more aware of the abuse potential of these drugs. And also patients should become more aware. So, you know, that the contract between the doctor and patient becomes less about demanding drugs. I think Leslie's entirely right that some of the services such as physio, pain clinics, psychology are difficult for doctors to obtain. And they're particularly difficult for doctors to obtain, perhaps in some areas of social deprivation where you're most likely to see these painkillers. We know that this is associated with depression. People get depressed if they're in less fortunate circumstances, if you like. So you're likely to get a magic mixture of doctors who don't have the resources and patients who are more desperate to find ways of making their lives better.
I imagine that there are also problems associated with, let's say, professionals saying, oh, gosh, they're all talking about this big problem, I'd better cut off prescriptions.
I think that's a really important point, because if you just stop someone's prescription, and I think we've seen it in the States, you can have the unintended consequence of them actually having to use illicit substances and not being able to manage. So while we might feel better to say, actually, we're reducing opioid prescribing, we need to make sure that there's appropriate support in place to help them manage pain in different ways.
Now, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, said earlier this week that there should be clearer labelling on opioids. Do you think that labelling at present is clear enough?
There is some labelling on prescription drugs that says they're addictive, but it's not very clear. I think the evidence of whether this works, and the best example is cigarette labelling, is not entirely clear, but we think it probably does help.
Do you agree, Leslie?
I do agree, and I think that has to be part of an overall strategy where, in addition to the labelling, there should be some additional education for the patient so that they understand what the potential long-term effects are of being on strong opioids.
How and when do you do that?
Well, so potentially, maybe that's delivered by the GP, but we know that GPs are short of time. Community pharmacists are the one who dispense the medication, so maybe there's an opportunity there to work through the community when they're picking up their prescription.
Emily, what does that actually mean? I mean, does that mean that if you go down to pick up your prescription, the pharmacist takes you aside and says, before I give you this, you should understand X, Y and Z, and do you?
It can mean that, and pharmacists do that for lots of things already. I also think they need specialist advice at times, and I also think, added to the preventative work, if you like, I think we also need to be sure that for people who do get into trouble, there are services available who can support them to come off these medications properly. They're not available everywhere by any means. And more of those sorts of types of provision would be a good thing to have.
Emily Finch there with Leslie Colvin. And I suppose the crude summary of all that is, let's not panic about a UK opioid epidemic on a US scale, but clearly prescriptions for opioid painkillers in the UK have risen, and it would make good sense to find out why. A thank you to my guests, Sam Quinones, Professor Rayford Brown, Dr. Luke Mordecai, Professor Leslie Colvin, and Dr. Emily Finch. We'll be back next Thursday. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Richard Fenton-Smith, and Serena Tarling. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. May I recommend our recent programme on climate change?
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.